7300 or go online at will.illinois.edu/support.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 20, 2011, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is one of our favorite guests who's been on the show several other times, Lawrence Lessig from the Harvard Law School, who is here to discuss his brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Should be a terrific hour. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to Larry Lessig, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Libby Reinisch.
Hearings began on Wednesday for a bill in Congress that could legalize internet censorship. Internet companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter, and eBay, along with public interest groups Electronic Frontier Foundation, Public Knowledge, Demand Progress, Free Press, and others, are fighting against it. The Stop Online Piracy Act would shut down websites suspected of copyright infringement. SOPA would also allow banks to freeze payment providers and advertising for the website owners. And all of this could happen without a court hearing. The bill is backed by the deep-pocketed entertainment industry and the Chamber of Commerce. Several members of Congress have come out strongly against SOPA. At a press conference before the markup, Representative Zoe Lofgren of California said that the explosion of innovation and creativity on the net was due in large part to the web's basic infrastructure, and placing the burden of responsibility on hosting providers and search engines would create a chilling effect on those companies and future innovation.
A basic tenet is that the platforms and the pipes don't have responsibility for the content that others put in them. If you're on the telephone, AT&T is not responsible for your conversation. Once there's a notice of a problem, then you have an obligation to act. That important principle would be put at risk if this bill were adopted, and the implications for our economy, for job creation, for innovation would be dire.
At the hearing, Lofgren noted that the witness list was stacked in favor of the bill and was concerned about the lack of witnesses to address technical problems that would arise from implementing the bill. Internet experts say the domain name system would be compromised and leave the internet vulnerable to malicious invasion.
You know, we've got six witnesses here. Five are in favor and only one is against, and that troubles me. I'll just say that. I don't think it's a balanced effort, and I'm sorry that we don't have any technical expertise on this panel in terms of engineering talent, because I think that is an important issue as to the DNS blocking portions of the bill.
For more information about the Stop Online Piracy Act, go to savetheinternet.com.
While the nation focuses attention on congressional efforts to cut federal funding for public media like NPR and PBS, a quieter effort is underway to cut state funding for local public media. As a result, local stations across the country are barely scraping by. Some no longer receive any state appropriations at all. A new report released this week details how support for public broadcasting is declining at an alarming rate. The report, On the Chopping Block, State Budget Battles and the Future of Public Media, is a first-of-its-kind inventory of state funding for public broadcasting. Free Press found that since 2008, 24 states have cut more than $85 million from public broadcasting budgets. In this year's round of state budget negotiations alone, state governments have slashed nearly $30 million from public media budgets. Josh Stearns, Associate Program Director for Free Press, co-authored the report. He said the cuts are undermining many stations' abilities to produce local content and reach every corner of the nation.
When public broadcasting was founded, it was founded under this ideal of universal service. And that ideal is at threat because of these cuts. We're seeing stations have to consider turning off transmitters so the most rural parts of the state won't actually even get the signal anymore. We're seeing local shows that are being closed and journalists being laid off. In some states, like in New Jersey, the whole signal was sold off by the governor to neighboring states. So now people in New York and people in Pennsylvania do the programming for New Jersey.
The state cuts also affect the amount of money the Corporation for Public Broadcasting grants each local station, meaning states receive less federal dollars when they receive less state support. Free Press is collecting signatures to petition governors to reinstate funding for public media and is meeting with federal officials to share the findings of the report.
Our stations need us not just to be fans, they need us to be advocates. And one of the things that we're committed to doing is helping build local organizing efforts around local stations to help buoy up and support new kinds of advocacy to help support local stations and make sure that we can defend public media.
To read the full report, visit www.savethenews.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. We have as our guest someone who I've been looking forward to having back for quite some time, author of a brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and the Plan to Stop It. Lawrence Lessig, our guest, author of this book. Larry, welcome back to Media Matters.
Great to be back, Bob.
As always, I devoured your book upon getting it, learned a lot. I'm going to be stealing from it liberally in the future, the highest praise I can give a fellow scholar. And just wanted to, for listeners maybe not familiar with your career trajectory, Larry, if you could start by talking about your work, and we've had you on in the past, has dealt with copyright, with internet policy, has dealt with intellectual property issues. You argued the Eldred case before the U.S. Supreme Court 6 years ago. How did you end up on corruption in Congress? What led you to that path, and what's the point of this research?
Well, after more than a decade working on these copyright and internet policy related issues and seeing lots of progress in the public around these issues, parents and teachers and businesses and institutions recognizing the need for an update of our copyright system and the need to protect things like internet neutrality. But recognizing there was no progress in the context of policymakers, an obvious point hit me that we weren't going to make progress in the policy field until we dealt with a more fundamental underlying corruption that makes progress in policy impossible for a wide range of important issues, not just esoteric issues like copyright, not just infrastructure issues like the internet, but fundamental issues like global warming or healthcare or, the complexity of our tax system. These were all areas where we were never going to make progress. This Congress has basically become stalemated around a wide range of these issues because of this underlying corruption. So I figured, I'd done a lot of work in this field. I had tenure. I adopted a rule that said every 10 years you should throw away all of your intellectual capital and start again. So that's basically what I did, and this is the first book that I've done out of that work.
How many more years till you have to throw this overboard?
It's about 7 right now, so we don't have much time to fix this.
Yeah, we better hurry at the show. We want to get it in by the deadline. Well, Larry, in the book you make a important point, and I think a lot of people, you don't oftentimes think of this, but when we think of corruption, of politicians or anything, your impression is of some wealthy person or some private interest, maybe collecting money, going in and paying off a politician or a regulator, giving them some sort of compensation in return they get something, and that it's a pretty much a blatant violation of law and certainly ethics. And you argue that that's really not the best way to understand corruption, right?
That's right, or at least it's not the best way to understand the corruption that's really destroying our republic. Our Congress is not filled with 535 Rob Blagojeviches or Randy Duke Cunninghams or William Jeffersons, people who have explicitly violated criminal laws by exchanging government favors for private benefit. Our Congress is filled with an extraordinary number of decent, honest, hardworking people committed to what they believe in, whether you believe in what they believe in or not. But they find themselves in a system where they have to spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress or to get their party back in power. And the point that I try to make is that that activity, which obviously leads them, as it would lead any of us, to develop an extraordinary sensitivity to the funders, is a corruption of the type of dependency which our framers intended Congress to have, which was a dependency, as Federalist 52 puts it, on the people alone. So if you are dependent upon the funders, you're not dependent upon the people alone, because the funders in our system of funding Congress are not the people. And so that corruption is the corruption, I think, that makes it so Congress can't begin to address a wide range of issues that it needs to address. And that's the corruption we need to worry about, not, you know, people like Rob Blagojevich trying to sell Senate seats.
Let's go into that and talk about that in a little more detail now, Larry Lessig. And I think that one of the, even before we go into specific case studies and examples of how this plays out on crucial policies, I think one of the striking things of your book, Republic Lost, Larry, was that you go into how the way Congress works has really changed radically in the last three decades from what, you know, we're taught in civics books and what I think I grew up thinking was how it worked. And it's almost an entirely different institution today than it was, say, in 1980.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, today I just had a piece in CNN, on the CNN blog, you know, responding to Newt Gingrich's claim, you know, when he was being asked about whether, you know, his being able to trade his influence for about $1.8 million in fees from Freddie Mac demonstrated he was just an insider. You know, AP asked him this question, and he said, what it demonstrates is that I have experience in Washington, and if you want to change Washington, I'm the guy who can do it. And what my piece tries to demonstrate is, yeah, in fact, that's true. Newt Gingrich is the only candidate who's actually succeeded in changing Washington. He's probably more responsible for the current architecture of Congress than anybody since Madison, because he launched a project in the early 1990s which had the effect of radically changing the way in which our Congress functions by focusing the effort of members on the job of winning control and keeping control of Congress by forcing them into a pattern of behavior of raising money both at home and on the road, and giving them the opportunity to do that by cutting the work week of Congress back to basically 3 days in those weeks in which it works, multiplying the number of committees so there are many more people that you have you can call up who need you to like them, so therefore you're willing to give them money. Just changing the institution into this extremely polarized institution devoted to the single task of maintaining control of one party. And that is new. It is really from the Gingrich Revolution on that we see this transformation. And that's kind of hopeful, because you can imagine, you know, it's within our lifetime, we can imagine getting back to something a little bit more healthy, a little bit more balanced, if only we could identify the core problem here and fix it.
One of the striking features of your book, Larry Lessig, that certainly got my attention, and I was somewhat aware of this, in fact, I was well aware of it, but not the extent of it, is the term you use in there is how Congress has become a farm club for K Street. And K Street, for listeners who might not be familiar with it, is the street that's associated with the lobbying industry, much like Madison Avenue is with advertising in New York. And the number, how really people leave Congress, and a very high percentage of current members of Congress or recent members of Congress will go on to earn spectacular incomes working as lobbyists. That seems to be, that's really the final achievement of a career now.
Yeah, and it makes it clear why it's going to be extremely hard to change the system, because the quote, farm league from K Street, I actually got from Jim Cooper, who's a Democrat from Tennessee, been in Congress for as long as all of about 20 other members of Congress. And he, you know, is devastated by the change in the character of the institution. And the change really is the rise in the number of people on Capitol Hill, both congressmen and staffers and bureaucrats, whose business model is a business model focused on their life as lobbyists. You know, so I teach it at a great American law school. Our graduates, some of them go to work on Wall Street. Their very first year working on Wall Street, they get paid as much as a member of Congress does. And like a member of Congress, at least one of these Farm League members of Congress, they expect to spend about 6 or 8 years making that amount of money, and then they hope to become partners. But my students want to become partners in a law firm and make $500,000 or $1 million a year. Members of Congress want to become partners on K Street and make $500,000 or $1 million a year. Now, as you can imagine, associates in a law firm are not actually very strong-willed souls to stand up to the partners in the law firm because they depend upon them and they want their futures, and their futures only come if their partners like them. That's the problem in Washington. Members of Congress are dependent upon these lobbyist firms who will hire them, and so they're eager to make friends, not to make enemies. And if you're making friends with the people who have all the money in the world in Washington, you're not making friends with Americans because Americans aren't represented in that mix.
You know, Larry Lessig, I'm reminded of a comment that Michael Pollan, the chair of the Federal Communications Commission under President George W. Bush's first term, and he said quite candidly, when he's talking to a corporate representative in his office in his capacity as chair of the Federal Communications Commission, you know, he knows in some ways he's always interviewing for his job once he leaves the FCC.
And, of course, he got an extremely lucrative job as a lobbyist after leaving the FCC.
From precisely one of those people he spoke to.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Our guest is Larry Lessig from Harvard Law School, the author of the brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts and a Plan to Stop It, just published by 12 Books. It's out now. You can call into Media Matters if you have a question or comment for Larry Lessig. The number here is 217-333-9455 and our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Now, Larry, it's been a little bit abstract so far. We've talked about the contours of the problem. Let's talk. Give a couple of case studies. So, like you said, so you can really see where the rubber hits the road and what the political, social, human impact is of a system where money comes to dominate Congress and pretty much drown out, I would say, pretty much all other voices on issue after issue. And yeah, I think the place to start might be with the news report we had on Media Minutes right before going on air. About the Stop Online Piracy Act, which is the latest venture by the intellectual property copyright-owning lobby in Washington, and the most dramatic effort yet to advance their interests. And maybe, I mean, if you give a little background on this, you know, what this lobby is, what their goal is, and sort of what their arsenal is compared to the librarians and educators and rock and roll musicians who are battling them.
Yeah, so this is the latest in really about a 15-year war where the copyright industries, who are enormously well-represented in Washington, have used their power to get Congress to pass ever more restrictive and punitive measures to punish what they call, quote, piracy. And I think that, you know, Zoe Lofgren, who's a congresswoman from California, and been quite an important leader in pushing back against this craziness. So Lofgren put it well in the introduction in the Media Minutes segment when she was talking about the fact that here we're going to have a hearing on this crazy bill, and of the six people testifying, five of them are in favor of the bill, and one is opposed to it. And there's no technical person who is able to explain exactly why the kind of changes that SOPA would enforce would weaken the infrastructure capacity of the Internet. Now, you know, you say, well, maybe 5-1 is appropriate because if you think in the world of people who know something about this issue, maybe five times the people who know something about this issue exist versus the one that opposed it. But actually, people who know anything about this issue outside of the narrow special interests of the copyright industry are wildly opposed to continuing this self-defeating war against our kids, as opposed to thinking about other strategies for addressing the problem of copyright in the digital age. Yet Congress cannot begin to think about any of these other strategies because both parties are so fearful of making Hollywood their enemy. And so we continue to have the kind of crazy policies that we have that don't achieve anything other than rendering a generation of our kids criminal. And my view is that there's not many things that would justify rendering a whole generation criminal, and certainly not this hopeless war that they're waging against, quote, piracy.
And Larry, to follow up on that, in the book you gave a figure which I think is astonishing, which is since 1998, the copyright industries have spent $1.3 billion lobbying Congress for a proper legislation. And those who look for copyright reform, just trying to limit it and represent sort of fair use in the public domain and schools and libraries and businesses that want to get into businesses that involve copyright, they've spent a grand total of $1 million.
Yeah, now, as I say in the book, it's hard to really get fair, accurate numbers there. So I put those numbers out there as a first cut, and I say, you know, even if they're off by a factor of 10, still you've got many times the amount of money on one side of this battle as opposed to the other side of this battle. And is it any wonder then that you have policy that looks so skewed and crazy? And I think, you know, that's just another example of how the system works across the range of important issues, not just in an area like copyright.
Yeah, and I want to get to some of those issues after we get to our next caller, but I just want to add one point for listeners who might not follow this issue closely. Oftentimes what we're talking about with extending copyright and making its protection more onerous, it has nothing to do with actually promoting culture. It's really about protecting existing copyrights for material that was done years ago and just keeping a monopoly franchise on it that much longer. It's just it purely represents the interests of those who own the copyright and have the lobby, no one else in the world.
Absolutely.
Let's go to our phone lines now. Our guest, of course, is Larry Lessig, author of Republic Lost. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like the guest to address the problem of campaign financing as well. I think that's all wrapped up in this. I think it's all tied together. It's all about money talking instead of voters and ideas talking. One idea I have, what would happen if I ran for office against Bob McChesney? And Bob and I agreed to a rule. If Bob raises $50, he gives me $25. If I raise $500, I give him $250. Is that legal? Could we agree for that to be legal? And wouldn't it take a lot of the hocus pocus out of what goes on in election campaigns today?
Thank you, caller.
Let me start with the general point and then the specific question. Absolutely. You know, my sacred text in my book is Henry David Thoreau's passage from On Walden, where he says, for every 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil, there's one striking at the root. And I call that person a root striker. And the whole objective of the book is to try to recruit more root strikers. You know, we all have our issues. My issue used to be copyright. Yours might be global warming, whatever. But we need to recognize how all of these issues have a common root, and the common root is, I think, campaign finance. Now, campaign finance is a problem not because there's money in politics. You know, we need money in politics. The problem is the money comes from a tiny slice of America. 0.26% of Americans give more than $200 in any congressional campaign. 0.05% of Americans max out in any congressional campaign. You know, so the Occupy Wall Street people are so proud of we're the 99%. They should say we're the 99.95%. who don't get access in the way that the 0.05% does, because the 0.05% is giving to campaigns in a way that gets the attention of members and candidates for Congress. So I think this is the problem, and I think we have to address that problem by finding a way to fund campaigns so that the people are the funders, and when Congress is responsible to the funders, it's responsible to the people. Now, with respect to the particular idea, I like the architecture of the idea. At least it would be better than what we've got now. Not as good, I think, as the kind of public funding proposals that I describe in the book. But in fact, right now, it wouldn't be possible for members to agree to that, at least in the sense of I got my $500 and then I turned over $250 to you, because I, as a candidate, would be limited in the amount of money I can contribute to you as my opponent, $5,000 in a primary and in a general election cycle. You could do it by, if you had a very elaborate device to say that when the $500 came in, you rebated it and you said to the person, okay, please send $250 to my opponent. The person might not be eager to do that if the person doesn't like your opponent much. So it could maybe in a cumbersome way be done. But I think that, we just need to bite the bullet and face the fact that we got to get people to understand the critical need for public funding of public campaigns if we're ever going to address a wide range of public policy issues that we all care about. And by we all, I literally mean we all. My strongest effort in the book was to demonstrate why this is an issue that both people on the right and people on the left need to worry about, not just people on the left. And I think we just need to take on the campaign of trying to convince the world of this necessity.
Larry Lessig, in the book, you also have a very illuminating discussion of the Citizens United case. And I think a lot of our listeners have heard the name. It's sort of become a catchphrase for letting corporate money be unaccountable and come in and dominate our politics. Could you explain the significance of the case and what it means for the argument you're making in the book and how we have to deal with that?
Yeah, so the simple result of Citizens United is that corporations, like individuals, have a constitutional right to spend an unlimited amount of money promoting or opposing any political candidate, so long as they don't coordinate that spending with the candidate. So independent expenditures, meaning uncoordinated expenditures, are unlimited using both corporate funds and in Buckley versus Vallejo from 1976, the court said individual funds. Now, this is a critical complication to the project of reforming the corrupting influence of money in politics, because before this decision, I think all that we needed to do was to achieve some version of public funding of elections. And we could have done that consistent with the Constitution just by passing a statute. But now I fear that even if we get public funding of elections, even if we get the ideal version of public funding of elections, there will still be an opportunity to exploit this independent expenditure liberty so that candidates may no longer be shape-shifting their views and attitudes to raise money, but they will become shape-shifting their views and attitudes in order to encourage the right kind of independent expenditures from extremely powerful interests that right now are demonstrating their willingness to spend unlimited amounts of money to direct the results in elections. So I think that brings us back to, you know, a very difficult recognition that ultimately we will have to get constitutional change if we, in fact, are ever going to achieve the kind of responsive, uncorrupted political process that I think all of us think we need.
Our guest today, Lawrence Lessig. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress, and A Plan to Stop It. We've got another half hour to talk with Professor Lessig. The number here at WILLAM 580 is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's start line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yeah, just two issues. Your comment. You're talking about K Street, the influence, but what about the influence of Glover Norquist, yeah, in the Republican Party? And the other issue is that I didn't realize until recently that Congress doesn't have to pay by the rules in terms of insider trading. Congress is legal for them to do that. So there's two issues, and thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Larry Lessig?
So Glover Norquist is an interesting character. He both is a, you could think of as a public policy advocate, you know, on the right. He leads a tax organization that has created the pledge that most Republicans have taken never to raise any taxes. And from that standpoint, you know, I disagree with the policy, but no one can disagree with the freedom of people to kind of run and lead public policy movements and to get as many people behind them as they can. But Norquist also has an interesting lobbying practice, or is supported in part, in effect, for lobbying. And that practice itself benefits when he can push Congress in a direction leveraging the tax pledge to support his clients. So, for example, let's imagine that there was a client who was getting a huge subsidy from the government to support ethanol production. You know, probably one of the dumbest things our government ever did, but there it is. The government has subsidized ethanol production, both not a green fuel, and an extraordinary expense and that has the effect of raising the price of food for no good reason. Okay, might be controversial in some parts of the country, maybe in your part of the country where this this comes from, but that's my view. There's the subsidy for ethanol production. If somebody comes along and says, let's eliminate the subsidy, and that's what Tom Coburn, a Republican in the United States Senate, has tried to do, does the elimination of a subsidy constitute a tax increase? Well, the Norcrest Group has basically said, yeah, it constitutes a tax increase, and if you increase taxes, you're violating the tax pledge, and if you violate the tax pledge, we will bring out our full guns to defeat you because we're going to defeat everybody who violates their tax pledge. And in my view, these two worlds are now a little bit too closely aligned, because it's one thing to have a principled view about the tax pledge. It's another thing to be benefiting personally from effectively lobbying in a way that is advancing really a crazy position about the need to continue government subsidies, no matter what the craziness of those subsidies are. So I think Norquist is an extremely important point about how this all connects into the system of corruption that is Washington, although I have no criticism for people like Norquist advancing particular political views, even if I disagree with them. The issue about inside trading is a little bit, I think actually a little bit complicated. There's some really good empirical work that's looking at all of the trades of congressmen and finding that on average, congressmen actually don't do better than the market. So it's a little contested, I think, whether in fact they're trading on inside information, but I completely agree they should be subject to the same rules. And I think we should go further. There's no reason why we should live in a world where we wonder at all about whether Congress is benefiting from the, you know, of necessity inside information they're exposed to. And so I think the critical thing to do is to have rules that require that when congressmen go to Congress, they've got to put their assets in a context that nobody could wonder whether they are trading in a way to benefit themselves personally. And many, you know, wealthier members of Congress do this already. They put their stuff into blind trust. But we should be able to make that process automatic and simple so that effectively everybody is doing that.
Our guest, Larry Lessig. This is Media Matters. Let's go to our next caller now. Line one, Slaterville Springs, New York. You're on the air.
Hi. About 7 or 8 years ago, I called in to Media Matters and talked with Professor Lessig about the application of copyrights to genetic-related things. And I'm still working as a public servant in agricultural genetics. And I'm happy to say the work that I've done, we've been able to give away to the best possible benefit in line with the ideals of the Constitution. Your latest book arrived here on Friday, and I haven't read it yet, but I'm hopeful about the book and about a particular thing. So I speak with, you know, talk to my father regularly, and we talk about, you know, what's going on in the world and what's changed in his lifetime and in mine, and he gets very, very frustrated to the point where he really just can't talk about it anymore. And my question is, do you think that the ideas in your book can reach people like my dad that are just looking for an answer, looking for a plan to make our republic better? And secondly, if you, I'm sure you do think so, but if you do think so, you know, can is there a way we can buy your book in bulk and get it out there?
Thank you very much, caller. Larry, I'm sure you like calls like that.
Yeah. You know, writing a book, as I'm sure you imagine, is extremely difficult. It's hard to find the right voice and the right for the right audience. And I certainly tried to write this book in a way that my own dad, who also is extremely frustrated by a wide range of things in this current democracy, could understand and act on. So the answer to the first part of your question is, I hope so. It was my intent, and I worked harder on this book than anything I've ever written before. So I hope I've gone some distance to achieving that. With respect to the second part, well, you know, my contract with my publisher permits me at a point we haven't agreed upon yet, but I hope soon to make my book freely licensed under a Creative Commons license. And so then at that point, yes, you can get it in bulk for free. Before then, you know, I'm amazed with how cheaply these things get made available. I understand that Public Campaign, starting tomorrow, is going to be making it available for $10 to everybody on its list. I think it's $16 on Amazon right now. I think that you can buy it in bulk for $14, you know, if you buy it through BookPal or something like that. But, you know, I think the key thing is to get people motivated to be caring about this issue, and that's the hardest thing. It's not the cost of the book. It's the recognition that people have to have that this is the root problem, and we have to figure out a way to solve it. And here's one try, one effort, one step towards solving it. But, you know, certainly I don't think mine is the last word, and I don't believe that, you know, my plan is going to be the end of this conversation. I just hope the beginning.
Professor Lessig, one of the passages in your book I found most interesting was your discussion of your attitude toward relationship with the Obama candidacy and the Obama administration. If I can summarize, I sense it was one of initially considerable hope and enthusiasm, and then once in power, less enthusiasm and a certain amount of dissatisfaction. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but explain, you know, your relationship there, your attitude, and what it means going forward.
So that's an understatement. I certainly, you know, Obama was a colleague of mine at Chicago. He was a friend. I supported every campaign he ever ran for. I worked to help get him elected president. I was most excited about the presidential campaign, not because I thought he was a liberal. I don't know why anybody really thought he was a liberal, but because I thought he was going to run a non-conventional presidency, in the sense of a presidency devoted to the objective of changing the way Washington works. It's what he said again and again in my book. I pull, you know, just some of the quotes of him sort of identifying the problem in the way Washington works, tied to the power of lobbyists, that this is the reason he was running for president, to change the system. And I thought that's, in fact, what he was going to do. He was going to get into office and execute on a plan to change the way the system works so that we could get back to a democracy where people had a reason to trust what government did. From day one, it was clear he didn't actually have a plan, and he didn't actually expect to execute on a plan. It was from day one, was suggested, and pretty quickly into the administration, it became obvious that the rhetoric about changing the system was just that. It was rhetoric. It was a way to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton and get a bunch of us who were eager to see reform help him rather than help the presumptive Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. Now, you know, you can have lots of excuses about how, oh, geez, we were in the middle of a crisis, there was too much going on, who could be executing on a plan, but I think it would be forgivable if we saw the administration trying to bring about the kind of changes that would change the corruption of the system and failing. But I think what's not excusable is absolutely dodging the whole effort to transform the system. And what that's left us with is an enormously frustrated public, especially people who voted for him, who think, you know, I voted for change, and what change was there? And I think that just will induce more of the cynicism that I think already infects our government.
Yeah, I think that was some of the best writing in the book and the collection of quotes you did, Larry, if I may say so. And I think your point, I agree with it completely, having spoken to lots of people who aren't especially political necessarily, but who strongly supported Obama precisely on the idea that we're going to clean up the system, and he meant what he was saying. And I sometimes wonder if the Rahm Emanuels and Geithners and Summers and Obamas of the world really understand that people actually took that stuff seriously, and that there are a lot of really angry people out there.
Yeah, I had this experience in July, just after I finished the book. I was in Aspen, and David Axelrod sat down next to me for breakfast, and I felt like this was a Marshall McLuhan moment. and so I turned to him and I said, you know, so what was the plan? You know, what was the plan? You made this whole deal about changing the way the system works, and what was the plan? And it was clear from him there was no plan. He told the story about how Obama, in his first budget, was upset because there were 7,000 earmarks in the budget, and he said he was going to veto the budget. And his staffers told him, "No way you can veto this budget. You know, you can't burn your bridges with the Democrats. You can't veto this." And I think that was a critical moment where, you know, had he vetoed this budget and come out strongly and said, "This system is going to change, and we're not going to play this game the way it's been played for the last 25 years." He would have been the Tea Party. He would have been the person symbolizing the radical transformation of this government that's necessary. But it was clear they didn't have a plan for doing it. They didn't have the stomach for doing it. They just didn't execute it. But I think that the more fundamental point that you make is really absolutely clear. At the same table was Joe Klein, you know, who obviously has been paying attention to presidential insider games forever. And Klein said to me, "What are you talking about? I don't remember Obama talking anything about reform. Why do you think that was the issue of the campaign?" And I was astonished. I was, you know, because I had done the research and reading every single one of his speeches and pulling out the time and again and again and again about him talking about reform. But the insiders to this system are so used to this rhetoric that they don't even hear it anymore. You know, it's just like the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning at school. You know, it's just a ritual you do. And you know, if anybody stopped and said, really, you're pledging? This is what you're saying? They would say, you don't understand what this is for. This is just a ritual we do. And that's what I think normal politicians think about this reform rhetoric. It's just a ritual. Nobody should take it seriously. You're naive if you take it seriously. And I think what we have to do is we have to turn around and say, you're naive if you think you're going to get away with playing this Lucy-like game every single election cycle where you tell us to run and kick the football and pull it and we, Charlie Brown, fall on our back. You know, I think it's time for Charlie Brown to stand up and say enough.
I mean, to some extent, as I hear you say that, Larry Lessig, I mean, I look at the Occupy movement that's going on in the country, and in a way, it seems like that is sort of the First Amendment response to having the rules rigged in Washington, just to go out and say, we're going to just let you know that's not cutting the mustard anymore.
Yeah, and I think that if the Occupy movements were to frame themselves in this way and begin to talk in a way about the corruption of the system and the need to fix that corruption, they could connect to a wide range of other political grassroots movements that share this view but don't necessarily share the substantive political values of most in the Occupy movement. I haven't seen good evidence yet that the movement is going to mature to be able to do that well, but I think that if it did, it could be the beginning of something quite important.
Our guest, Larry Lessig, Harvard Law School professor, author of the brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, just published by 12 Books. Let's go back to the phone lines for another caller. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree completely with everything you said about Obama. But I heard you on the Diane Reams show, and you were quite good on that, quite good there. It's great to hear that coming from Washington, D.C. And but I wanted to know, you had mentioned something about a voucher system for campaign finance, and I was wondering if you could reiterate it here, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, thank you for the kind words and the opportunity. Yes. So if the problem is we have a system where the funders are not the people, one way to make the funders the people is to adopt a version of a small-dollar public finance system. So, you know, we have something close to this in Arizona and Maine and Connecticut for state elections. But the version that I describe in my book would apply to federal elections. And it basically works like this. The first thing you've got to assume, and we can argue about this, but I think it's easy to show it's true, is that every voter contributes at least $50 to the federal treasury. So take that first $50 that each of us sends to the federal treasury, whether through income tax or payroll tax or Social Security tax, and rebate it in the form of a democracy voucher. And with that democracy voucher, we can then fund congressional campaigns, give it to a candidate for Congress, so long as that candidate for Congress agrees to take only democracy vouchers plus up to $100 from any citizen in a contribution to support the campaign. So campaigns would be funded in this system either through $50 democracy vouchers or through contributions maxed out at $100. Now, if a majority of candidates opted into this system, and when Connecticut launched its system, more than 80% of candidates opted into it in the first year. But if a majority, a significant majority, let's say 65% of Congress, opted into this system, then the critical thing to recognize is that whatever reason Congress might have had for doing something stupid, which it, you know, inevitably will do, whether it's because there are too many Democrats or too many Republicans, the one thing it would be impossible to believe was that it was because of the money, because we had removed money from the central driving focus of Congress as they raised their election, that raised the money for their election, or at least more precisely, we would have removed the big dollar contributions that come from the tiniest slice of America from the mix of this election. And instead, we'd have a system where they're funding their election from the broad range of us who are, you know, doing something with our democracy vouchers. So $50 a voter is more than $6 billion. That's 2.5 times the total amount raised in 2010. And that means it's a significant amount of money. It could actually have a significant effect in changing the way Congress funds its elections. And it would give us an opportunity to actually believe in what Congress does when it acts after being elected by small-dollar funds only.
Larry, one of the things you just pointed out earlier is that such a small percentage of people actually make large donations, individual donations, not to mention the corporate and Citizen United stuff going on, that it, for most Americans, and you put this in the book well, I think, it's rational that they sort of tune out and say, well, this isn't my game. I'm not a player here. I have no role to play. It's all for big money. And I think that dissuades a lot of people from wanting to participate. But the other point I face personally, and I know friends I've talked to face, is sometimes there's a politician you really would like to give money to, whatever it is, you really think they're great. But you realize that in a close race, maybe 60, 70, 80% of that money is going to go to a television station to run some idiotic, insulting, offensive, stupid ad. And it just sort of burns your butt that you're having to pay money. You're giving money that's going to go to a TV station for a license to public spectrum to run an idiotic ad.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously I learned most of my spectrum skepticism reading from, you know, the endless amounts of fantastic work you've done in this area. So I don't need to tell you and probably your listeners either about the craziness of the way in which we've allocated spectrum and have not at least benefited from the public for that allocation. But the one thing that is obvious, and I think you nicely point to this too in the I can't remember exactly the title. It's a very clever title. Your last book, The Decline and
Rise of Death and Life.
Yeah, The Death and Life of
American Journalism.
American Journalism. You know, it was one thing. It would be one thing in 1970 to be focusing on the public airways. But it's a different story today, because even if you were to liberate the public airways in the sense that you could say the public airways have to be devoted to free advertising for political candidates, an increasing percentage of what people are consuming has nothing to do with the public airways. So, you know, cable television or the internet have a different relationship to this underlying argument about the public ownership of basic resource, because we might own spectrum, but we don't necessarily own the fiber that gets laid from our house to some switching box. So I think we need a more general solution that cuts across these different property platforms, and you know, creates a funding system we can trust and have reason to believe in. I agree with you that I think most of what gets spent, the money gets spent on in political campaigns right now, is hard to have much excitement about, and nothing that I'm talking about is actually going to change that much. Maybe if we had a different kind of tenor or rigor to our politics by eliminating the need to be so polarized, that might actually help us solve that.
Larry Lessig, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Larry, you discuss this a bit in the book, and I think it's a point that I'm greatly interested in, want to see more work on down the road, and we'll hopefully do programs on this, which is our judicial system is also being greatly transformed right now. And in research I'm doing for another book with John Nichols right now, we've been looking at how the judicial system in America was perceived. And it's becoming clearer to me that the notion that I grew up with, and I suspect you did, that, you know, the court system basically was fair and just and worked, has not always been that case. That in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the judicial system was considered extraordinarily corrupt and on the take. And that it really was cleaned up significantly in the middle parts of the 20th century. And now it seems like we're heading back into a zone where the trust in our judicial system is shrinking dramatically, not just with appointed judges who are politicized, as with the Supreme Court, but in these state elections where there's just an enormous amount of money going and flooding these elections, almost all coming from, you know, commercial interest. And where does that fit into your argument?
Yeah, so first, I haven't grown up yet, so I don't know what you're talking about what I knew growing up.
Okay.
Second, yeah, and I think that I look forward to this book because getting a historical perspective on the trust or confidence we have in institutions is extremely important because we kind of take what we have today and assume it's always been thus. So, I think right now we have very high trust in the kind of federal judicial branch from the standpoint of corruption, like money corruption. A lot of us are skeptical about the political corruption of the judicial branch, at least at the highest level. And there's lots of work that tries to suggest that even at the appellate level, there's too much sensitivity to political views rather than what we would think of as legal views. But I don't think anybody credible really believes that money is driving, the money that might directly or indirectly benefit justices is driving what the Supreme Court does. But at the state level, that's completely different. States adopted a really stupid progressive idea from, Jackson's the first to suggest it, but really takes over in the beginning of the last century to make these judges elected. The reason for that was it was thought to be a solution to the problem of corruption because, if you could elect them rather than have them appointed by party bosses, it would be harder for the party bosses to use the appointment as part of their corrupt scheme. So I understand the motivation for it. But what it did was, or has done recently, is just make them instead answerable to a different kind of party boss. Now it's the corporate party boss that is very keen to spend enormous amounts of money to direct the elections in ways that guarantee a state court that's favorable to the people who are funding the interest. So, the Supreme Court addressed this in a really, in the scheme of things, in a small case, in the West Virginia case, this case Massey versus Caperton Cole, this is actually parallels a plot in a John Grisham novel, The Appeal, mm-hmm. where Massey Cole loses at the trial court level some $50 million judgment against it for all sorts of bad behavior with respect to the way in which it was managing its coal mines. And then as it's being appealed, the president of Massey Coal spends $3 million in independent expenditures to support a particular candidate for the highest appellate court that's going to hear the case. And that candidate wins, and that candidate then eventually casts a vote, which is the deciding vote that basically reverses the judgment against the coal company, and it goes back down. And the question for the Supreme Court was, does that create the appearance of impropriety, even if, you wouldn't say directly that you had any evidence that there was any bribery or any direct influence, and this was an independent expenditure, so it shouldn't have been coordinated, but does it still just give too much of a flavor of influence that it just reeks for the political system? And the Supreme Court said yes, and they created a constitutional right to challenge such cases where the judge refuses to step aside because of just the flavor of, mm-hmm. of corruption or bribery. Not bribery, but corruption or improper influence. That's a small example of a practice which is much more systematic and pronounced, especially in states like Illinois, where an enormous amount of money is spent, especially in the context of insurance companies, to get the right kind of justices. And then those right kind of justices do the most extraordinary things to benefit the people who have funded their campaigns. And it's extremely hard to, or I just think it's unfair to expect of the public anything other than the cynicism which the public increasingly has towards these judges. I think the solution to this, in this context, I don't think we should be publicly funding. I think we should go back to an appointment system we can have some confidence in. Because it doesn't seem to me that we need to be electing judges in any of these contexts. We can be appointing judges that have the right kind of credentials, and we can think of all sorts of creative ways to make sure they're not too politically.
Frankly, I'm at the point, as I look at some of these decisions like you've been talking about, as I study it, where I think we'd almost be better if we had like a jury selection of registered lawyers and just grab them out of a hat.
Absolutely.
We'd get fair treatment. Yeah. Lira, we've only got a few minutes left, and one issue that I'd like you to talk about, because it's the heart and soul of your solution, which is constitutional reform. And it's an issue that is done rarely, especially the Constitutional Convention, done never. But it's in our Constitution. You're a constitutional lawyer. And when this has come up in the past in conversations I've had with folks or with stuff I've read, it's, you know, the idea of having a constitutional convention, you get the impression that the most deranged lunatics in the country will suddenly be writing extraordinary changes in the Constitution that make life miserable, that is the worst possible thing that could happen. And when I read your discussion of it, it had a very different presentation of how it would take place. What does a constitutional convention mean?
Right. So the framers had in Article 5, had a plan for amending our Constitution, which was originally just to have Congress propose amendments and have the states ratify them. And then somebody said, well, what if Congress itself is the problem? And so they said, good point. What we need to do is make it so that we have a way around Congress. And so what the way around Congress is that the states get to call on Congress or petition Congress to call a convention. And that convention only has the power to propose amendments. And so the convention meets, it decides which amendments to propose, then those amendments get sent out to the states by Congress to be ratified. And if three-fourths of the states, 38 states, ratify those amendments, they become part of the Constitution. So, true, the convention could propose crazy amendments. But 38 is a huge number in constitutional politics. 13 states could block any proposed amendment. And there are plainly 13 red states and 13 blue states out there, so neither side needs to fear that the other side's going to somehow take over and do something extremely crazy. You might not have a lot of faith in state legislatures. I actually do, but you might not. But you've got to at least have faith in 25% of state legislatures to block really crazy reform. But I think that there's even more upside to the convention process than that makes it sound. Because in my view, going back to your randomly selected lawyers, I actually think that there's good reason to believe that randomly selected citizens as part of the convention would come up with much more sensible, much more public-spirited, much more public-interested proposals for changing the Constitution than any 500 politicians would ever do. Because the thing is, this is the one sport where the amateur sport is actually better than the professional, because the professional is, a professional politician is very good at knowing exactly what to do to keep his or her interests happy, special interests happy. Whereas the amateur, if you can summon them to focus on this in the right way with the right information and in the right context, can actually think about the public interest in a way that I think most people would find quite important and inspiring. So I realize that sounds like a really crazy idea, maybe the craziest idea in this book. And that's why I say that we should be right now launching a series of mock constitutional conventions where we randomly select 300 or 500 people from a state or from a region and run what Jim Fishkin calls a deliberative poll around constitutional issues. And then let's show what 50 of these mock constitutional conventions produce as a way to demonstrate what I think would be demonstrated, that that this convention process, even just including ordinary citizens, would propose and produce reform that would be extremely inspiring and important reform that could actually help us out of this constitutional mess.
Larry Lessa, we've only got a little less than a minute or so left. I know that you mentioned Root Strikers earlier and that you formed a group that's connected to your work, Root Strikers. And if I'm not mistaken, that's also connected with United Republic. So for listeners who want to get involved, take the next step, where should they go?
So if you go to rootstrikers.org, you can join us in a project which is going to be devoted to finding every single possible creative way that we can to get ordinary citizens to recognize the root to the problems they all identify. So we have an extremely important public education process here that's not going to happen by, 30-second television ads or by the president lecturing people on television. It's going to happen by people at a dinner table or at a meetup or at a bar, talking about this issue in a way that begins to make ordinary Americans recognize what I think some of us have become obsessed with. So that's the easiest thing to do, is go to rootstrikers.org and sign up and join the project. The other important thing you can do is you can buy 10,000 copies of my book and give it to your 10,000 best friends, or at least 9,999, keep one for yourself.
All right, Larry Lessig, author of Republic Lost, I want to thank you for taking time from your schedule to join us today at Media Media Matters.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
It's been great having you. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Christina Williams for working the board today. Melissa Trentz, my producer also. And Kyle Croha, the engineer. It's been great, everyone. Be back in 167 hours and have a great Thanksgiving.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Today, mostly cloudy with a high near 50 degrees, north-northeast wind around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, a chance of showers after midnight, cloudy with low around 40 degrees, east-northeast wind between 8 and 10 miles per hour. Monday, cloudy.